Morgen Salme Bitz, mir war Frankfurtis Universitätis Schederebiti etzna enat metzniere bis Institutis Professori. Da morgen Salme Bitz Frankfurti dann. Magram dres inglesurat la parakop imit omrom holot sami saati guaksta. Kartulat zaljan nelat holot vlaparakop imitom inglisurat jobia. I will be speaking about digital humanities and cartvelology, and I want to start, if this works, with describing to you a program that we have been running in Frankfurt in the past 3 years and which is still running. It's a project called Digital Humanities Hessen. It was financed by the State of Hessen, the Ministry of Sciences and Arts, within a program that is called Landesoffensive zur Entwicklung wissenschaftlich-ökonomischer Exzellenz, State Offensive for the Development of Scientific and Economic Excellency, short abbreviated as LOEWE, which means LOMI. Our project is called Digital Humanities Integrierte Aufbereitung und Auswertung textbasierter Corpora, Integrated Preparation and Analysis of Text-Based Corpora, and has been running since 2011. The partners are Goethe University in Frankfurt. This is where our institute is situated now, in the 9th floor of this and in the 11th floor of this building. Everybody who had seen our university before and remembers the very nice village villa we had before. This has now changed, but maybe it's even better for digital humanities. Another partner is the Technical University of Darmstadt, which is close by Frankfurt, and within Frankfurt, the Frankfurter Goethehaus, Freies Deutsches Hochstift. This is actually the building where Johann Wolfgang Goethe was born, but it was completely destroyed in the war, so it had to be rebuilt. Within the project, we have 5 project areas. One is about historical corpora, one about contemporary corpora, one about archive, corpus, and edition, one is about multimodal corpus management, and one is about the question, what is digital humanities? Within historical corpora, the objects we deal with are the verification of interrelationships in historically transmitted corpora or corpus languages. That means we are dealing with translated texts and parallel corpora. On diachronical levels, we are dealing with language change and the affinity of language. And also within this part and within this area, we are dealing with corpus-based historical semantics. I will return to that a bit later. Some sub-projects of the parallel corpora area are closely related to your studies, and this is why I want to talk a bit more about this. Not the first one, which is on Old High German and Old Saxon, the text tradition and its interrelationship with Latin, but the second one, which is about the Caucasian Gospels, their mutual interrelationship and their interrelationship with Greek, Syriac, and other traditions. And yet, beyond that, we had a project on the old Turkic Buddhist tradition and its interrelationship with Sanskrit, Chinese, Sogdian, and other traditions, but this is not so much the topic of today. Within the contemporary corpora area, we deal with text data analysis and corpus analysis with respect to 3 questions, namely texts as products, text as instances of the linguistic system, and text as processes. This is all dealing with modern languages, mostly German and English, but it should be transferable at least to historical corpora, historical semantics, and edition science. So this is the interaction of analyses done on modern languages and then taken over into ancient languages. Within archive, corpus, and edition, we deal with the redefinition of classical interfaces using digital methods, collection versus archive versus edition, the question of critical apparatuses, and the problem of the visualization of data in online editions and image-text relations, mostly concerning manuscript. And this is beyond linguistics proper. This goes very much into literary sciences, and I will show you some examples. Within this, again, we have something that is closely related to cartvelology, not the Avestan Yasna tradition, which is old Iranian, but the old Georgian gospel redactions, their delimitation and their interrelationship. And this is, closely linked with the Caucasian Gospels project. In image-text relations, we are dealing with, for example, the illustrations of scenes from Goethe's Faust, which maybe you know is one of his major works, and their interrelation with the text. The recovery of stroke-out text passages in the letters of Ludwig Börne, who was a journalist working in Germany in the beginning of the 19th century, a Jew who converted to Christianity, and his letters to his friend Annette Wohl are very interesting in this respect. And the third one, which is relevant to what we are dealing with today, namely Caucasian palimpsests and their edition. The multimodal corpus management project is, so to say, the umbrella of all the projects we have, because this is trying to bring in the digital aspect to an extent that is necessary to work on those topics. What it has to provide is, for example, a flexible annotation model. I think you have heard a bit about annotation systems, and this is now a bit beyond what people are doing normally, because it also comprises the annotation of images in texts and so on. Then the development of data models for statistical analyses, and statistical analysis is an important point in many of the subjects we are dealing with. And then the text technological integration of the annotation and the data models and so on. And then lastly, the project question, what is digital humanities? Here we are dealing with transdisciplinary reflection of the current change of methods that digital means have brought about, the validation of the benefit to be gained by networking and synergy, and the question whether the digital turn is a paradigm shift in the humanities or not, and the question, maybe you will be able to answer that question yourself after this winter school. I want to dwell upon two topics now that are relevant for cartvelology. One is the project on Caucasian Gospels, or rather the two projects. The project workers in this are Leyla Tsamushia and Natia Dundua, and we have two associated IT specialists who do the digital thing about it. This is Zahurul Islam and Armin Hoenen. The task is to determine the interrelationship of the old Georgian Gospel versions with the Greek and Armenian versions, and it is interrelated, as I said, with the project on the redactions of the Georgian Gospels, which is a sub-project of the Critical Apparatuses project. We had to start with very much manual work in this, and what you see here is what we call a collation, an interlinear collation, of all existing Georgian, old Georgian text variants, together with the Greek and the Armenian text in two versions. This is not yet finished, because also for the Greek and also for the Armenian, very many variants will have to be added, but this could be a 100 years project, so we have to refine ourselves to what we can do in a 4 years time. But anyway, the Georgian witnesses, which had been prepared for many years before in some other projects, Darijan will remember what I'm talking about, this will now then be taken as the input into the digital work on these variants. One thing, again, that could be done semi-manually is the identification of key verses which contain noteworthy discrepancies. Like, for example, this is just one example of very, very many. Matthew 4.25 contains in three manuscripts only four place names here, namely Galilea, Ad Kalaki, Jerusalemi, Dazir, Jordane. And here we have a fifth one, Huriastani, in five of the witnesses, whereas the Adishi Gospels contain nothing of that. So the question is, how does this come about, and what is the relation of this diverse picture with other, namely Greek, Armenian, or maybe even other Bible versions. The same approach is also being done for another Bible translation of the 5th century, namely the Gothic Bible translation. Is anybody here who does not know what Gothic is? Well, yes, you don't know, so
yeah,
you do know. No, I was asking if anybody does not know what Gothic is. Yeah, yeah. Yes, yes. Very good. Thank you very much. And this Gothic Bible translation is peculiar because it was done on the basis of the Greek. This is what we know. But the Goths then moved from the Balkans, where they were translating the Bible, to Italy. And in Italy, they came into contact with the Latin Bible. And so their Bible text reflects in the Codex Argenteus, in the Silver Bible, reflects both the remnants of the Greek translation and an adaptation to the Latin text. So that here you have two times the same information in two different wordings, because the one reflects the Greek and the other one reflects the Latin. So this is a very similar case and a very peculiar case. And we have to build up the same principles, the same methods, in order to analyze these kinds of interrelationships also for the Georgian Gospels. Then what we are doing is applying big data approaches. I think you mentioned big data sometime earlier in this winter school. This means the application of algorithms and methods that have been developed on large parallel corpora. Large corpora is something very different from just a Bible translation. Large corpora means something like 7 million pages of text or whatever. And this has been developed on the basis of a big collection of parallel corpora, Europal, which is text from the European Parliament that have been translated from English into French, German, Netherlands, and I don't know which other languages. And on the basis of this comparison, characteristics of translated texts have been established that can be now be tested towards the Georgian Bibles and any other text of this kind. Typically, translated texts are more explicit than non-translated texts, because in the translation, ambiguities are reduced because the translator had to think about ambiguities. Translated texts add explicational words like therefore, then, and so on, which are not there in the original text sometimes. They also tend to be more simple. The simplification, translated texts are syntactically simpler than original texts normally because they are not so sophisticated. Translated texts tend to be shorter than original texts also. But the thing that is most important for our research is the last one, adaptation. Translated texts always keep some traits of the underlying language. That means the language from which they were translated. And this is what we will be searching for. Another approach that has to be done still is building and using sample corpora. In order to make a statistical analysis in the sense of an entropy rate of a sufficient amount of old Georgian texts, you will have to build up a corpus, a parallel corpus of old Georgian texts that were directly translated from Greek originals, and we do have a lot of them. And also, on the other hand, old Georgian texts that were directly translated from Armenian originals. And then we can see what are the differences in those texts in order to find out whether a given trait is Greek or Armenian in the Georgian texts. And the evaluation of characteristic features of these two types of old Georgian texts can, for example, concern pronoun usage, the so-called articles, tenses of verbs, etc. But there is a big problem with this, because this can only be done reasonably if we have done lemmatization before and disambiguation before, and I think you talked a bit about that, and this is now going on. And after this, we can apply something that we call automatic stemmatization. I think you know what a stemma is. A stemma is the tree of the development from one given original manuscript by copying the manuscript into various branches. And this, for this purpose, Meanwhile, several programs have been developed or are being developed. One of them is StemmaWeb, which has been developed by Tara Andrews in Leuven in Belgium. StemmaWeb is a collection of tools actually for the analysis of collated text, and it's freely accessible. The only problem is it's not yet able to deal with Georgian, so we have to transcribe Georgian into some kind of Latin so that it can use it, but I hope this will be better soon. Using this, we can then contrast the results of automatic stemmatization with those of a manual analysis, as would have been done by editors before or by creating a critical edition. And this means that we have to search for statistical preponderances with the automatic process, and we need the philological skill, the human skill, for the manual analysis. And if we take both together and they both come to the same result, then the actual stemma will maybe appear. The expected results are the clarification of the interdependency of the Georgian and Armenian versions of the Gospels with the Greek text, and this can then later on be also extended to other Bible texts, and the clarification of the number of redactions of the Old Georgian Gospels and their witnesses, and this can then later be extended to lectionaries and other secondary witnesses, which is a very important thing to do. So something that could come about is stemmas like this. You see that some tree-like structure starting reading from the left is observable, and that some manuscript belong together in this analysis. This is a very different one because it relates upon different criteria, and this is still another one. But even on the very first try, some very typical results came about, like, for example, that the version of Adishi is different from all the others, so it represents a branch in its own right, and this is true, as everybody knows, and if this comes out by an automatic stemmatization, then the automatic stemmatization may be a good way to get on with. Second, we are dealing with the point of view of cartvelology, is manuscript analysis. This is an old Georgian palimpsest. I wonder whether all of you know what a palimpsest is. In any way, I will dwell upon this a bit more later on. This is one of the letters of Mr. Berner, which I was talking about, and what you see here is that somebody tried to strike out a part of the text in order so that we could not read it, but of course we want to read it exactly because it was struck out, and so this is an interesting task. So what does applying digital means mean here? It means to make erased and overwritten text readable. It means to prepare editions of the overwritten texts and to prepare online publications of the overwritten text. And for this purpose, a person whom you all know, because he's sitting here, has been working for quite some time on developing an editor for this kind of texts, and hopefully this will be available to the public by the end of this year. I hope so. Yeah. Okay, other topics that are or may be relevant to cartvelology from our big program, but I will not talk about them today, are historical semantics. In historical semantics, we are applying collocation analyses to the determination of historical change in the semantics of political key terms of medieval historical texts. And the methods developed there can, of course, in the same way be applied to historical texts of Georgian, like Kartlis Tschovreba or something like this. This is a very promising approach, and we are looking forward to test it for the first time also with Georgian. Another thing that we are working on intensively is named entity recognition. Maybe it's good to leave it a bit open in order for some exchange of air. It's not noisy outside. Okay, so another thing that we are intensively working on is named entity recognition. If you're dealing with a text, a newspaper text or a historical text or whatever, and There are some names in it. Names are always difficult to identify for a computational program because they do not declare themselves, and many people have the same name. So if somebody is called Nino and there are two Ninos talked about in the given text, then how to distinguish them? Or sometimes it's all, only a pronoun is used in order to refer to a person. So what we do here is applying collocation analyses to the determination of persons, places, etc., that are denoted by identical names or epithets or pronouns, etc., in literary text corpora. And this is meant, first of all, for automatic indexation, but could also be used for other purposes. So this is something, a point of view of literary sciences. And lastly, ontologies. I don't know whether you've talked about ontologies within this winter school. Ontologies and research description framework is a method of pointing out relations between something like persons, places, a literary text, and so on. This is taken from the project of the Faust illustrations. So imagine the text of Faust is printed in an edition with some pictures showing Mr. Faust and Mrs. Gretchen in a certain environment. Then a whole set of relations between this image, the persons that are painted in the image, and the text itself can be drawn up. And I just want to explain the basic idea, that relations consist of three elements, which are sometimes called subject, predicate, and object, but this is not the normal linguistic way of using these terms. So, for example, a person A died at town A. This is a typical relation between a person and a town, and died at is what the person does with the town or what the relation is about. And this whole system of relations can then yield also to town A being part of another relation. Person B was born at town A, or a museum where the image is located at town A. And this kind of relations are most easily described in a RDF, that's a research description framework, and this is being developed, for example, in our project on the Faust illustrations, but could also be used, and this is my idea, for example, for a big database of inscriptions from Georgia. Okay, this is the end of my introduction. If there are any questions, I would ask you to ask them now, before I go on to the second part.
Very, very short question.
Yeah.
How usable is the last picture for a Webkristallsammlung, for example?
Well, it depends on what you want to describe in Webkristallsammlung.
Ontology.
Yes.
Trans-persons, subject, object, and predicate.
Yes, of course, you can describe the persons, and it's a fixed set of persons, like I didn't count them, maybe 12 or so that appear in Webkristallsammlung, and their relations to towns and places, to another, to one another, and so on. All this can be described by this also.
It's
yes?
Just kind of visualization of this relation or something else?
No, but it's the basis for a visualization.
Right.
So when you have set up the database consisting of these relations, then you can use this for a visualization.
All
yes,
right.
Exactly. Yeah. Any further questions? Okay, if not, to Kartulat. Okay, so then we can go on to the first major topic of today, namely translated corpora. Practically all old Georgian texts were translations, as you know, with only very few examples that are exceptions, like Shushanik Istzameba. And we are dealing with translated corpora in the context, for example, of the Old Georgian Gospels. Some of you may know that I've just come from Jerusalem, and this is why I want to start in here with Jerusalem and cartvelology under this topic. This is a very famous picture of Jerusalem, but it has practically nothing to do with cartvelology. This is different because this has very much to do with cartvelology. Is anybody here who knows what this is? This building? Darija knows, of course, yes. Anybody else? No? Yes, this is Jivris Monastery, the Monastery of the Cross. And this is a monastery that was founded by about the 5th century. It was destroyed when Jerusalem was destroyed by the Persians in 614. And it was rebuilt by Georgians in the 12th century. And it has been in use by Georgians until the end of the 19th century. And I will return to this later. This is another picture, and you see how beautifully this is arranged in a valley. This is the inside of the church of the monastery, and you see it contains very many frescoes and inscriptions, both in Georgian and in Greek. And this is a fresco which contains St. Maximus the Confessor and St. John Damascenus. But the most important image is the small one below. Anybody knows it? Yes? Yes, this is a man called Rustaveli. Who can read the inscription? Who tries? Hmm? Yeah, where's Shota? Shotay, with a yod here, you see? This is Shota. This is Rustaveli, Rustaveli. But what is this? Amisa? Amisa? Mm-hmm. Shotai? Sheitzkalos? Gmertman Amin. This is all abbreviated. Okay? Okay. So, why do I show it to you? Just in order to relax a bit. A few years ago, the image looked like that. And this is what you can see in the internet. This was an image taken when a certain Mr. Saakashvili visited Jerusalem in 2004. And he was very offended by seeing that Shota Rustaveli's image had been destroyed. And there was even a big conflict with Greece because the monastery is now in the hand of the Greek Patriarchate. This is an image of 1987 where you can see how it looked like before. And meanwhile, it has been restored and in quite the same way as it was before. So we can be happy that the destruction here has been amended. So the two images of 1987 and of today are nearly identical. This would be something that might go into a database of Georgian inscriptions, of course, not only describing the text of the description and saying that this is from the Monastery of the Holy Cross, but also the interrelationship with the surrounding images of St. Maximus and so on. This all could be described in such an ontology as I've showed you before. The question who destroyed it or who scratched it in before 2004, I'm not quite sure that this was done by Greeks, because if you see that here very many graffiti have been written in Arabic, so there are so many other peoples also going around there. And when I was there, it was a large group of Russians, so everybody could have done this. The reason why this was destroyed or scratched is very simple. This is at the height of a man, whereas Maximus and Ioanne are much higher, so you couldn't reach them. But if you wanted to destroy images, then this is the only one you could reach. So I don't even think that somebody had something against Rustaveli, but simply they wanted to destroy images, and this is what they did. Okay, so now we return to Jerusalem and cartvelology from the textual point of view. The Monastery of the Holy Cross was very, very important because it is the place outside of Georgia that hosts the largest set of manuscripts, of old Georgian manuscripts, more than Mount Sinai, St. Catherine's Monastery, and more than any other place outside of Georgia. The manuscripts are no longer in the monastery, but they were taken into the Greek Patriarchate in Jerusalem, and I tried to see them when I was there, but unfortunately the construction works in the library are still going on, and I was promised that within a year's time I will receive an answer whether one day we can see those manuscripts again. So I think since 1990 nobody has ever seen them, and they are closed. The first description of the manuscripts of the Monastery of the Holy Cross was done by Niko Chubinashvili, Chubinov, In 1845, this is actually the first description of a collection of Georgian manuscripts that exists. This was printed in Alexander Tsagarelli's book «Сведения о памятниках грузинской письменности» in 1894. That means very many years after Mr. Chubinashvili was in Jerusalem. And Tsagarelli himself then was the one who provided the first real catalogue in 1888. And this is very important to have because this describes the collection in the state of 1982 or 3 when he was in Jerusalem. The next one who visited the library, the books, was Nick Omar together with Ivane Javakhishvili. He went to Jerusalem in 1902. And then the manuscripts were already in the Greek Patriarchate and no longer in the monastery. And very many of them were missing. So they had been sold or given away when the manuscripts were transferred from the monastery to the Patriarchate. The last one who made a catalogue is Robert Blake, who made his catalogue in the 1920s. And this, again, is, of course, not as complete as the one by Tsagarelli, because this contains still the manuscripts that were there in 1882. Okay, before we go back to the manuscripts later, another interesting point for cartvelology within Jerusalem. This is a 100 meters by 50 meter of a basin of water, which was empty now, and this has a peculiar point of view for cartvelology. Because it is mentioned in a text of the 9th century in Old Georgian, which is called the destruction or the conquest of Jerusalem. It's a text about the event which I was mentioning before, namely the destruction of Jerusalem by the Persians in 614. It is by an author with the name of Antiochos Strategos, who was an inhabitant of Jerusalem of that time, maybe even an eyewitness. And the Georgian text describes this very lake, which is called the Lake of Mamilla. And this is the short passage. You can read it, and I think there are two words in it which you might not know. One is Utevan. Who knows what Utevani is? Yeah? Well, in Greek, it's a stadion, and this is 180 meters about, okay? And this is a word that was used in order to mark distances. And the other word you might not know is this one, Birka. Anybody ever seen it? Sorry? The lake, yes. Okay. And this word appears in the Arabic text of the same content. This means Birka Mamilla, and this is the Lake of Mamilla. So the idea is that this Georgian word, which is very, very rare, was taken over from Arabic, and this implies that the whole text was translated from Arabic, which is no wonder, because if it was translated in Jerusalem in the 7th or 8th century, then the original was in Arabic, and they had to translate it from Arabic. Yeah? Okay. So, one other interesting thing is that Utevan means stadium, and in the Arabic text you have two different ways to describe the distance. One is this, Ramyatain Nashab, and the other one is Nisf Mil. Nisf Mil means half a mile. So the lake is half a mile from the center of Jerusalem. No, from the Tower of David. And it's two shots of an arrow from the center of Jerusalem. And this is true. I went there, and it's, I would say, some 500 meters. That's quite okay. And as a matter of fact, Utevani, as a word, means the shot of an arrow, originally. It's an Iranian loanword in Georgian, which means exactly that, the shot of an arrow, and it's two shots of an arrow, and this is what is translated also here from the Arabic. Okay. In another place, in the same text, the same lake, Mamilla, is mentioned with a different word, namely Pliskina. Has anybody ever heard this word, Pliskina? No. It was also new for me. But it appears in another old Georgian text, namely the text of Basil the Great, Basili Caesarielli, on the creation of the world, the Extra Dreta text. And here you see the text passage, and he speaks about Orthkli, Dinaretasa, da Tbataisa, da Zwataisa, da Pliskinataisa. So you can imagine that it means something that has to do with water, and means a certain amount of water, like a sea, a lake, or whatever. The Greek text of the same of Basili contains potamoi, krenai, tenage, limnai, pelage. So this all is even five words meaning certain amounts of water, but it does not have the same word. So again, the question is, where does this word come from? As a matter of fact, this word comes from Latin. Latin piscina means a small lake, a fish lake, so to say. Yes? Yeah? Exactly. And this is still used in French today. Piscine is exactly the word used for that lake in the French description of the site in Jerusalem. La piscine de Mamila. So piscina was borrowed into Greek in the form piscine and appears as early as in the writings of St. Hippolyte, Hippolyte, that means in the 2nd and 3rd century. This is a very early loan from Latin into Greek. The same word must also have been borrowed into Arabic. Arabic has no P, this is why it's called fiskina there, or also fliskina. And it seems that this latter Arabic word is the one that yielded Georgian pliskina. It also yielded in Greek piskine or pliskine, a word form that appears only very late in the 13th, 14th centuries, so that you can see the Arabic has taken over the word and then given it on to other languages. And if Ilya Abuladze is right, who proposed that the Georgian text of Basili Caesarielli was translated from Arabic, then we have another word from Arabic that is an indication of this, and the same word also appearing in the text of the destruction of Jerusalem. So our question now is, how can we use translated corpora to establish the history of words? That's the one point of view. And the other point of view is, how can we use such words to establish the history of translated texts? So it's a mutual interdependency of two points of view. The one is taking the words to identify the source of a given text, and the other one is taking the parallel corpora in order to find out where a word comes from. The question is, from which language is a text translated? In the case of Old Georgian, as I said, most texts are translations, but not always you know which source language they had. Also, the question when it was translated, because as you've seen with the example of Pliskina, it is very important to know that the one or other form is only very late or very early, and where it was translated. So it's no wonder that the text on the destruction of Jerusalem was translated in Jerusalem, of course. And how can we analyze parallel texts with digital means? Brings us back to digital humanities. Any questions as to this point? Fantastic, no, but any questions? Okay. So, dealing with translated corpora. We have done quite a lot of this in the Titus project. I think this was mentioned before, wasn't it? So I need not be very long about this. Titus was conceived as the Thesaurus of Indo-European Texts and Linguistic Materials, and it is available under these two addresses. It has been running since 1987, and it has been online since 1995. You can read something about the 25th year, which we've celebrated last year in the article indicated here, and I think you will have the links and so on after this winter school. The primary scope of the Titus project is to provide an online text database comprising the textual heritage in ancient Indo-European languages, that means corpora, the textual heritage in adjacent non-Indo-European languages, also in form of corpora, the textual material in less known or studied in European languages of today, and the textual material in Caucasian languages and other languages. And the huge amount of texts we have collected so far are available under these two URLs. The secondary scope is to provide a comprehensive retrieval system for the text materials, including the documentation of original sources like manuscripts, inscription, audiovisual data, and so on. Then to provide language-specific linguistic analyses, language-specific cross-text concordances, and this is the most important point for today, cross-references between parallel texts. Because within parallel corpora, you need cross-references. And for this, we have devised two methods. One is intratextual arrangement. This is, for example, something which we've provided for the Gothic Bible, and I will show you that in a minute. We have also provided the same thing for St. Nino's legend, the conversion of Cartley, and you will see how this is done. Another method is cross-references with links, and this we have provided for other Bibles, for example, the Old Church Slavonic Bibles like the Codex Marianus, but also for Old Georgian Bibles like the Adichie Codex. All this presupposes an identical referencing system, and I will now try to get online to show you how this looks like. Well, it does work. I wondered whether it would. So this is the Gothic Bible, and you see here the arrangement of the Gothic texts in Gothic script, the same in a Latin transcription. You see the script is not very different from Latin, but it was produced on the basis of both Greek and Latin and a few Germanic runes. Then the Latin text and the Greek text, all this side by side so that you can see immediately how the text works. It also contains a link, namely to the image of the text in the manuscript. So you said the codex, the silver codex, unfortunately the images are black and white, which Swedish colleagues produced in order to make them better readable. But anyway, it's better than nothing. It's very beautiful, yes. Next example, the conversion of Cartley. Yes. This is not yet open for the public yet, but it will be, hopefully, in some time. I did the same thing yesterday, but it didn't keep it in memory. So, here you have the arrangement of different passages from Mokceva Kartlisa, the three versions we have. You know that one additional version of Mokceva Kartlisa has been found on Mount Sinai in the so-called New Finds. But actually, this passage is only in the Shatberdi version. Then you have the version from Kartlis Tsovreba. You have the versions from the two metaphrastic legends. And where it exists, you will see there is also then the Armenian text and the Latin text of Rufinus included in that. So you will be able to use this because you will receive a password for this. The other system which we've applied, for example, in the Old Church Slavonic Codex Marianus, is a bit more simple. Here, too, you have an interlinear version showing the text in two different scripts again, namely the Cyrillic script and this script. Who knows what script this is? Ever seen?
No.
No one? This is the so-called glagolitic script. This was actually the first script invented for writing down Old Church Slavonic, but this has been given up in the 16th, 17th century, so nobody uses it today. The Codex Marianus was written in that script, but normally editions are then in Cyrillic because this is what people can read. Then here you have 5 links linking the text to the respective passage in the Greek Bible. Or in other Slavonic texts are, sorry, it doesn't work now. No, but actually the Greek does work, and so you have it here, okay? So this can be linked to several other versions. And the same has been done, for example, for the Adishi Gospels. And here you have a link to the Proto-Vulgate texts, a link to the reduction of Georgi Mtatsmindeli. Here you have a link to the Greek text, and you have a link to the Armenian text. So this is what I would call a static linkage. And this can be done easily on Bible texts, because Bible texts normally have the same structure. The structure is identical. Practically all Bible transmissions begin with Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And within Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, it's the same sequence of chapters and verses, which can be applied to any kind of Bible. There is one point about this that we must not forget. This is that this kind of internal division into chapters and verses is a very, very young phenomenon. It was not used in the first millennium. It has only been introduced by about the 15th century of our era. And we will see later on how an older version of referencing looked like. So we have seen this, we have seen that, and we have seen that, and we have seen this. So if the link, if the online link wouldn't have worked, I would have shown you that. Okay, now we are thinking about a combined approach for texts that do not share with Bibles this predisposition. So texts that are parallel, but not 100%. That means that even the internal structure, the sequence of paragraphs and so on, may not be identical. And in this case, you cannot simply provide an interlinear text because there are some deviations. And the examples I want to show for this is taken from Gregory of Nyssa, Grigol Noseli, the text on the construction of man, Shesak Misa Twiskatsisa. And we've done, together with some colleagues in Belgium, we've provided chapter 30, where we have taken the Greek original text, two Latin versions, one Armenian version, two Georgian versions in parallel for comparison. There are also a Syriac, two Arabic, and a Church Slavonic version available of this text, so this has been really translated into practically all languages, but it takes quite some time in order to bring about all these texts into one system. So what is necessary here is the establishment of a common referencing system that is not in the text itself. In the Bible, it's part of the text, as you might know, but in some other texts, it's really arbitrary. Somebody does a division into chapters and somebody else makes another one, so you don't know what to do. Let me just introduce the text versions. The most ancient text is the Greek text, the original, which was written in the 4th century. It has been preserved in 145 manuscripts, which is quite a lot, divided into two types. One consists of 31 chapters, with chapter 12 divided into two, and the other one consists of 30 chapters. And you will see that the translations either reflect one or two. There are two editions, one is the very old one, and the other one has been done in the 19th century, so actually a new edition would be needed. The first Latin translation was by one Dionysius Exiguus, done in the 6th century, has been preserved in 5 plus 19 manuscripts, plus one, so we don't know the exact number because nobody's ever written about it, but we know that it contains 31 chapters, like Greek A, and the list of titles, which is also a distinctive feature of some of the versions. This has also been edited twice, once in the 16th century and one in the 19th. The second Latin text is by a Scottish scholar named Johannes Dunscotus Erjugena from the 9th century, who intended to improve the first Latin translation in order to get back a bit closer to the Greek, and you will see an example showing this. This has only been provided in one manuscript from Bamberg. Some of you might know where Bamberg is, Darijan, you remember? Yes. This is a text which contained 30 chapters, like the first Greek version, but here chapter 22 is missing. So this is actually one point where the interlinear arrangement has a problem. And this has been only edited once. Then the Armenian version was done in 717 by Stepanos Sionetsi and David Hippatos in Constantinople. This has been preserved in about 30 manuscripts in Yerevan and 11 manuscripts in Venice. You know that Venice is a site which hosts very, very many Armenian manuscripts because there is a monastery of the Mkhitaryan sect of Armenians. The oldest manuscript is from the Mate Nadaran in Yerevan from the 12th and 13th century. This contains 32 chapters, something new, because here the prologue is counted as a chapter, which in the other versions is not counted. So again, a difference. This has been edited recently by a lady named Vardanyan. Now the Georgian. The first Georgian version of this text is from the 9th or 10th century. We know it from a codex that I've already mentioned, namely the famous Shatberdi codex from the 10th century, which is S1141. Has anybody ever seen the codex in the National Center of Manuscripts? Darijan has seen it, presumably. Yes? Okay. It's a very, very important codex because it contains an amount of texts that are only preserved in Georgian as translations from Greek or from Arabic or from Armenian or from whatever, where the other texts have got lost. For example, some texts of Hippolyte, which I've already mentioned. Another codex that contains the same text, the same Georgian version, is the Jerusalem Codex number 44, which I was not able to see, unfortunately. And this is from the 12th or 13th century, but it contains actually the same text with but a few variants. And in the two editions by Ilya Abuladze and Bakar Giginejshvili and Elgujag Yunashvili, the variants from the Jerusalem Codex are always mentioned where they are relevant. There are some later copies of from the Shatberdi Codex, like these two, but they are not very relevant for establishing the text. This contains 30 chapters, so this is like the second Greek version. The second Georgian version is by Georgin Tatsmindeli and was produced in the 11th century on Mount Athos. And we do have the autograph, that means Georgi's own manuscript, Athos 49, containing it, plus quite a lot of manuscripts that are copies. This again contains 30 chapters like the second Greek version, and it has just been edited a few years ago by Ektime Kochlamazashvili. The Church Slavonic text is very much later. It's from the 14th century. It has been preserved in five South Slav codices from about the 15th, 16th centuries. And this again has 31 chapters like the Greek version and has been edited in a book by Lara Sells in 2008. Then the Syriac version, which must have been done before the 8th century, is only preserved in one manuscript from the Vatican Library in Rome from about the 6th, oops, sorry, this. Where I am. Yeah. From the 6th and 9th centuries, it must contain 31 chapters according to what we know, but nobody has ever edited it, so the only information we have on this is taken from Lara Sell's edition of the Old Church Slavonic manuscript. Then the two Arabic versions, it's even worse because the first version, which must also have been produced before the 8th century, is simply lost. Nobody knows whether any manuscript exists of this. The second one, which was provided by one Abdullah ibn al-Fadl in 1052, has not been edited, so we know practically nothing about the manuscripts and nothing about the chapter structure. And again, the information we have on this is taken from Lara Sells, but also from Ilya Abuladze's edition of the Georgian text, because Ilya Abuladze tells us that this, namely the first one, might have been the translation model for the Georgian text. And remember that we are looking for indications of the translation model in the text. So we are now, we have tried to build up a preliminary online publication consisting of the Greek, the two Latin, the Armenian, and the first Georgian version. The second Georgian version I've received only in January, so this was too late in order to implement it, but we've taken the most important passages out of it. Chapter 30 is now here standing for the last chapter, because in those versions that have 31 chapters, this is chapter 31, not 30. But anyway, the chapter is the last chapter of the text. And we have tried to cross-reference these five versions on the clause level. I will show you how this looks like. First of all, the individually prepared Greek version. And you see, this is just the Greek text, sentence by sentence, or rather clause by clause. You see that this is sentence 3a, 3b, 3c. And that means this all is one sentence in the sense of what sentence means. But for the comparison with the other versions, as you will see, it's important to make smaller units. And the smaller units are what we call clause structure. This then is linked with... it's a bit slow. With the interlinear arrangement of the several versions. And here you see the Greek text and the two Latin texts, the Armenian and the Georgian. I will come to that later. Second, the first Latin version looks like this. And it contains the same division into clauses wherever this is possible, because sometimes it's not possible, as you will see. I skip the Latin too. Let's look at the Armenian. And this is again the same. There are no big differences in the first sentences, and then the Georgian from Shatberdi. Okay, and this again has 3a, 3b, 3c. Okay, the same, and the synoptical text arrangement I've shown you before. So now the problem is actually the Georgian first version. Why? Because this is the most deviant version of all. It's very, very different with respect to its wording. You can see that the Armenian was translated word by word from the Greek. You can see that the Latin versions are translated word by word from the Greek, but the Georgian is very different, so that it's even sometimes very difficult to find the corresponding passage in the Greek text. And this is only a minor list of the major divergences. Paragraph 20, so within chapter 30, paragraph 20 is missing totally. This is not there. Paragraph 21 and 22, 1 to 3d follow in the Georgian version after 24. 22, 4 follows in the Georgian version after 19, so that you have a sequence. 19, 22, 4, 23, 24, 21, 22, 1.23, and 25. And this is not easily arrangeable in an interlinear form. And also sometimes it's simply the exchange of two clauses of one sentence that you can see in the Georgian text. So a full interlinear arrangement is practically impossible with the Georgian text. Some examples. Clause level divergences. This is from paragraph 27. Sentence 5, parts or clauses B and C. You see here that the Greek, the Latin, the Armenian, and the second Georgian version speak first about warm, getting warm, and then about getting cold. Gan khurdebis, gan sivnebis. The first Georgian version speaks first about cold and then about warm. It's exactly the opposite way to go. And this cannot be explained simply by a mistake of a translator, but there must something else be behind it.
By Georgian character.
Sorry?
Can you explain by Georgian character?
by Georgian characters, not in any way, no, because the translators normally would know what they were writing. No, there must be something else behind it. If somebody translated this text from Greek, there was no reason why he didn't start with Tbili and then came over to Krinali. Yeah? No reason. Okay, this is even worse, because here there is a divergence not only between the Greek text, the Georgian text and the others, but also between some of the other texts. This is a sequence which we call a conditional sentence, a conditional sentence structure containing a so-called protasis and an apodosis. Are these terms known to you? So it's a sentence like, if he did something, then something would follow, okay? And in all, practically all languages, you can do this in the sequence I've just done, like if, the if sentence first and the then sentence after it, but you can also switch it around. So this would be bad if he did it, okay? And this is what we have here. So the red colored is the protasis, that means the if sentence, and you see the Greek text has the if sentence following the apodosis, which is in blue, okay? And you see some of the translations do it the same way, and the other ones put it around because it's logically a bit easier to understand if the protasis comes first. So putting the protasis first is a bit helping the understanding. You remember that I was talking about the features, the characteristics of translated texts, and this is one feature that you might observe, that it's a bit easier to understand, and that's why the translator turned around the sequence of protasis and apodosis. What about the green parts, which you have in the Armenian text and in Georgi Mtatsmindali's text? This is an additional protasis, which makes it still a bit more clear what is meant. So this is again something that is typical for translated texts in order to provide some more clarity for the text, something maybe added. You remember that this was also one of the characteristic features. But then comes Georgian 1, and Georgian 1 is the most deviant as always. And you see that it adds just a very small word which turns the whole sense around, namely ara. So man is weak, udzrav, and so on, but here, if man were not weak. This, of course, must be seen in the context. So the context explains then why here the way of thinking is very different, but this is not just what I would subsume under simplification of text. This is a different text in this sense. Okay, and then, very interesting, again, divergences on the word level. We've talked already on words that are indications or possible indications of the source for a translation. And this is a sequence of three words in the Greek text, kroko, balsamo, and mekoni, which all describe plants, plants that contain some juice. So actually the meaning is the water that gets into the plant from the earth, turns into a certain type of juice in the plants and comes out from the plants in a certain type of juice. And you see the sequence is the same in this Latin version, red, green, blue, in the Armenian version, and also with Georgi Mtatsmindali, kurkuma, valsamo, and mikoni. Anybody who knows the word mikoni? Ever heard? Mikoni is, what is it, akacho, mon, akacho, yes, yeah. And kurkuma is clear, and balsamo might also be clear, okay? And this is exactly the translation of the Greek, what we have here, and you see mikoni is not only a translation, it's the Greek word, mekon, mikon, yeah? In its later itacistic pronunciation. And you have the same thing in Armenian, mikoni, and kurkmi, and yaprasami. So kurkmi is the same as kurkuma, and it's actually the same as Greek krokos, but it's not the same word. This is the word for balsam, which is balsamon in Greek, which is valsamo in the Georgian version, it's balsamo in Latin, and Armenian here has a bit a different word, which is aprasam, aprasam with an r in between. It's actually not the Greek word, at least we can say. But obviously the Armenians had their word for balsam before, and actually it is the same word etymologically, but it's not taken from Greek. But both the Greek and the Armenian are probably have taken the word over from another language, maybe Iranian or whatever. So now again, look at the first Georgian version. What we have here is Zaprani, Barsaboni, and Nergi. So Zaprani is okay because it means the same thing as Krokos in Greek. Nergi, Nergi is very unspecific, and it's not really a good translation for Mykonei, because this is a peculiar plant and not just a Nergi. Okay, no idea where this comes from. But the interesting word is Barsaboni. Barsaboni has the same R as the Armenian Aprsam, and it's obviously not taken over from Greek. So again, the question arises whether the Georgian text was probably not translated from Greek, but it might have been translated from Armenian. Well, I don't think so, because Armenian is very close to the Greek, and there is no reason why Mykonei should have been translated by Nergi. And why they should not have... Oh, sorry. Where are we? No, here. Okay. Why they should not have used curcuma, but Zapran, when starting from Armenian. No. The idea is it might also have been translated from Arabic again. Okay, let's go on. The same word, Barsaboni, occurs in the whole Titus database only in one other text. And this is a text we already know, namely Basilik Esarielis, text on the 7 days, Shrita Dreta. So read this passage from Basili, and you see that it's about Gomizi, Askinoisa, da Barsaboni sei. Okay? Askinoi, Askino, I think, will not be known to anybody of you, because it only appears in this text and only at this place in this text. And it's obviously the same word as the Greek, schinon. And this, again, is the name of a plant. It's called mastich. Schinon. Okay? But if it's from the Greek, skinu, then it shouldn't have yielded askino in the Georgian version, because there is no reason why a should appear before sk in the Greek. So again, this was the reason why, or one reason why Ilya Abuladze proposed that the text of the 7 days was translated from an Arabic intermediary source, where a might have been the article al-skinoi. And this had been reduced to askinoi, even in Arabic itself, and this was taken over then as one word. And this would then give the idea that also Barsabon might have been influenced, or the translation of an Arabic word in the given context. And if it was in Vasili Kesarieli's text, then why shouldn't it be the same in the text of Gregory of Nyssa? So both texts might have been translated from Arabic. Actually, the word Gomizi does not tell anything. Is the word still in use today? Gomizi? No? Well, it means, what is it? Resin, Harz. What do you use for this today? Harz, Rezina. Harz, nein. Harz. Harz, das, was aus den Bäumen so raustropft. PC. Na, PC. Albert. Gomizi. Dialektische Arsebobs. Aha, dear. But this is actually an Iranian word. So anyway, we could still also... Well, Gomizi is an Iranian word in Old Georgian, and this might also then indicate, as in the case of Barsaboni, that the vocabulary here is influenced a bit more by Iranian words than in other cases, which might also be interesting for finding out what actually the original was. The problem in both cases is that we do not have the Arabic text of Gregory of Nyssa, Grigor Nosseli, and we do not have the Arabic texts of Basilik Esareli. So one might try to retranslate the Arabic text from the Georgian one and then see whether this could be found somewhere. Okay, just to get back to the question of when the translation was done, indications of the time when the translation was done. The word valsamo for balsam does appear in Old Georgian, for example, in the text by Flavius Josephus on the Antiquities of Judaism. And it translates the Greek balsamon. But this has a clear indication of a younger age, namely the V in the beginning. You know that within the history of Greek, B changed into V. We cannot tell exactly when, but Georgian is very important for this because Georgian has always kept V and B distinct. And so Greek loanwords in Georgian show exactly when this change happened. This translation was done by the Gelati school, and this means 12th, 13th century. And so this gives us an idea that before that, the Greek pronunciation must have changed from balsamon to valsamon. Actually, the best indication of spoken Greek in Georgian is not loanwords, but the hymnaries of Jerusalem, which contain the beginnings of Greek hymns in Georgian script, because there you can see how Greek was really pronounced. I've written an article about this, but it has not yet been published, so once it has been published, I will send it around. Another text that shows the same valsamo is from the same age, 13th century, the Visramiani, which you might know. So, Atzra is the Visnadzvi, Ratkan Chemiche, Valsamo, Esatzaikza. And the Visramiani, as you might know, is a translation from Persian. Now, the Persian text has been edited by the same two scholars, like the Georgian text, Magali Todua and Alexander Gwacharia. And the Persian text reads what you can see here. I will not pronounce it now. But the problem is that the Persian text at this place is not very clear, or at least it's not very beautiful. So if you read the translation, is anybody here who speaks Persian? Uh-huh. Okay, so let's read the English translation. In the garden now grows spruce and box tree, since that noble box tree has not remained. And this is a bit contradictory, isn't it? Yeah? Because if box tree grows, then why has it not remained? Okay? And actually, in the edition, in the critical apparatus, the editors say that the second part of this verse has been restored and has not been preserved correctly, obviously. So the idea now is, this is wrong. What would stand here is not the word for box tree, which is shemshad, but the word for balsam, which is balsan. It fits perfectly well into the meter. And then we have the same idea as in the Georgian text. Namely, that now it's only spruce and box tree, nadzvi, that grow up because the beautiful balsam tree is no longer there. Okay? So here, this is one of the many cases where the Georgian translation of the Visramiani gives the hint as to reconstruct the Persian original text. So this is also an important point in providing corpora of translated texts. Okay, so I come to the end of the first part of my speech of today. What are the digital humanities tasks for translated corpora? The most important task in the beginning is cross-referencing. Whenever you do research of this type, the first thing you need to have is a referencing system where every single item of the translated and text and its original are referenceable. Okay? This means, of course, chapters and paragraphs, but it must go deeper into sentences and, as we've seen, clause and phrase levels, and sometimes even the word level. You've seen that the sequence of the three plants was not the same in all three versions. When you've done this, then, this can be done automatically supported by digital means wherever possible. That means you can use statistics, you can use collocation analyses and other means in order to have this done automatically to a certain point. As I said before, for the Bible it's quite easy because we have all been used to the same structure of the Bible throughout for all kind of versions. Here in such an environment where the text may even differ to a larger extent, you can try to figure out whether automatical means can help you in dividing the text into equal units. Then further tasks are the indexation and cross-indexation. So on the world level, if you do an indexation, then you can build statistics upon these indexation in order to figure out whether a text is typically, say, Greek-influenced or Armenian-influenced or Arabic-influenced or whatever, because it has some peculiar traits in the words that it uses. This presupposes grammatical analysis and lemmatization. And on the basis of this, then you can build up word equivalences, so that means registers of one Greek word and its translations in the Georgian text and so on. This can then be used as an input for statistically supported cross-referencing, as we've seen before, but only if the differences are not too big. And I would propose that for the Georgian first version of the text of Gregory of Nyssa, this will yield no good results because the text is too far away from the Greek text, from the Armenian text, from the other texts. So as long as we do not have the Arabic text, this will not yield a good result. So all this, in any way, can be used and should be used to determine possible or probable or even certain translation models, but I would say we are just at the beginning of establishing a system of tools and means for achieving this purpose. Thank you very much. Now we can have a coffee.